Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away. Take it away.
Hey, this is the Linux Link Tech Show, Linux World Expo episode, special episode 3, where we have two interviews on this episode. First interview is Michael Loeffler from SUSE.
Open SUSE Project.
He's
the project manager with that.
Yes.
And he gave us a really cool overview of what Open SUSE is and how it relates to Novell and how it relates to the regular SUSE releases.
And some of their upcoming projects. So enjoy.
All right. We're here speaking with Michael Loeffler from the Open SUSE Project. Thanks for coming on, Mike.
Hi.
And all right, well, let's start off. What differentiates Open SUSE from SUSE?
Quite a lot, as OpenSUSE is the project. So at OpenSUSE.org, it's a kind of portal where the community can find each other. So there are mailing lists hosted. It's a wiki where everybody can put his content in. We have ISC meetings going on. And out of the OpenSUSE.org project, we invite the community to deploy with us, with SUSE Linux, the upcoming community edition of SUSE Linux. So that's the biggest difference.
Now, is it like a developmental and testing ground for the SUSE software that will they eventually gets rolled into what Novell would release as their open desk?
Actually, the testing bed is the community version, SUSE Linux, which is, as of today, 10.0 is out, 10.1 comes end of April. But with OpenSUSE.org, we opened up the deployment. So we have now an open bugzilla, so people can report bugs directly into the development and on our IRC meetings and on the mailing list. The community can discuss with the development things they think are positive or not so positive. So they are much more involved in deployment, and the really test bed is the distribution which comes out. So SUSE Linux, the community edition has a release cycle of 8 months and is the base for the business products of Novell Linux business products. So 10.1, which is out end of April, will be the base for the code 10 business products of Novell. So the SUSE Linux enterprise server and the enterprise desktop.
Are you guys taking the approach similar to what Fedora does with Red Hat?
Roughly, yes. So it's an open source project sponsored by Novell. At the moment, the largest sponsor is Novell. So it's similar, yeah.
How's the reception been in the community?
The reception, from my perspective, is very good. OpenSUSE.org started last year in August, and we have till today more than 20,000 registered users at OpenSUSE.org, which is still growing. With the OpenSUSE.org project, we offered for the first time free download of SUSE Linux with the launch date. Prior to OpenSUSE.org, we delayed the free download always for 2 to 3 months. So the download was appreciated very much. So we're facing at the moment 7,000 to 8,000 installations a day, and with 10.0, yeah, we're going in the direction of 1.5 million in installations.
Wow!
And this is much more as we had prior to the OpenSUSE.org project.
There's a lot of buzz around 10.1
yes.
coming out, and it sounds like it's going to be a phenomenal desktop. I know there's a lot of people looking forward to it. And we're talking midsummer?
10.1 will be out end of April, beginning of May. First for free download at OpenSUSE.org, and with a delay of 2 to 3 weeks, we will offer it as usual as a retail box in Best Buy's, CompUSA, or all over Europe as well. Amazon is a good place to purchase it.
Now, how long have you been with SUSE?
I'm now 3 years with SUSE.
3 years. So you came in right before Novell.
Exactly, some months prior to Novell acquired SUSE.
And how has the atmosphere of SUSE, the company, been since you were there before, and now you've been there during the transition and after? Is it really exciting? Is it just as exciting as it used to be, or more exciting?
It's really exciting, as of course with a acquisition, or where light is, there's as well shadow. But in general, for SUSE Linux, it was very positive being acquired by a larger company. So prior to that, we were mostly present on the Europe market. We tried to step in the North American market, which is very tough and very expensive. And now with the acquisition of Novell, we are able to offer SUSE Linux worldwide. And for example, the OpenSUSE.org project wouldn't be possible without Novell. As prior to the acquisition, SUSE Linux relied on the revenue and margin coming out of the physical box very much. So with OpenSUSE.org now, Novell gave the opportunity to the community first to give something back and get the software for free.
Being from SUSE before Novell came in, were you primarily a KDE desktop user? And are you still a KDE, or are you
I'm both. So
you're
I'm
both?
I used to. SUSE Linux is very known for KDE folks hanging around. So if you get a laptop from your IS&T, there's KDE installed. But I personally use both.
Use both.
Especially as I should know from both worlds a bit. So I try to switch desktops monthly.
Okay, yeah. So then TEM1's going to have both SUSE and TEM1 is going to have KDE and GNOME, right?
Yes, of course.
Support for both.
Yeah.
And XFCE?
Yes, as well.
Yes.
We deliver, yeah.
So I guess
many desktops.
If Novell were to say, this is the direction we want to take the enterprise version of SUSE, we'd still have the SUSE version, the open SUSE version, which, you know, you wouldn't have to go with what Novell thinks is the right way with the enterprise version. That the SUSE project is going to be, the open one's going to be more flexible, so to speak. And, you know, if Novell would say, well, we don't want to support XFCE, the open SUSE project would take that over, correct?
Yeah, correct.
So
One thing is, for example, Novell decided for their business products to install GNOME per default. And with SUSE Linux, we still have, in the business products, KDE is delivered as well. But per default, it's GNOME. And with SUSE Linux, the community edition, during the installation, the user is asked, hey, which desktop you'd like to install. So it's a user's choice there.
So do you think we're going to start seeing more of that with other distributions too, particularly commercial, that with Novell and doing all the usability studies have said, this is what our customers are looking for, so they gear the distribution, their version of SUSE, configured that way, and not so much as a choice up front, but delivering to what the customers are asking for. And then for people who've been running Linux who say, whoa, wait, we like that choice, we've got the open SUSE is what they should be going for. Is we going to see more of that with other distributions, do you think?
I don't know, actually.
Is that the direction that you see, I mean, in your opinion, you see corporations or commercial or corporate Linux going?
Or at least for it still is important for open source project getting some backing from commercial businesses. So, but as of today and at OpenSUSE.org, we're quite free, and there's the place where the community can talk to us, and we can listen to them and see which package or which project is important or for which project is demand out there. And especially at OpenSUSE.org, we of course like to offer this variety of projects and packages on the distribution.
Now, one of the hot items that they've been talking about is Banshee and being able to deliver an open source licensed music player or audio or multimedia player that supports MP3 out of the box. Is that available for the OpenSUSE project, or is that only available in a commercial box?
Yes and no. At OpenSUSE.org, as it is an open source project, we offer a open source distribution. But we offer as well a distribution which those nice add-ons, proprietary add-ons, like an Real Player, which is responsible for playing MP3 with Adobe Reader and so on. So at OpenSUSE.org, you find both. If you are a open source guru and you say, hey, no proprietary stuff comes to my hard drive, no problem, there's an open source version. If you say, hey, I'd like open source, but Adobe Reader, it's just useful, so you can have a version with Adobe Reader, for example, as well.
So you can get both of those at the OpenSUSE website.
Exactly.
So you can download the free, and then there's a separate commercial or non-free disk, I guess it would be. So it's all available.
It's all available, and the funny story is, even with the version with proprietary stuff, I would say 95% still is open source. There's just some packages like Flash Player, Real Player, Adobe Reader, which is proprietary. The rest is open source.
So when Novell opens up something like iFolder, does that then make its way into the OpenSUSE repository so then anybody can grab that?
The iFolder client is included in the SUSE Linux distribution as well.
And then it's the
AppArmor, for example, or Mono.
So then the server would also be available since they opened it up, or?
If it's open source, yes.
Okay.
As far as the development model, as far as having developers come in with the OpenSUSE project, what areas have people come in from the community as opposed to coming from the Novell side of things? Are there any certain pieces of the puzzle that the people come from the community?
The community actually comes from all over the place. So there is no special dedication or special area they cover. But for example, what the community already did, they came up with two distributions, or they enhanced SUSE Linux. They made once the super distribution, which is more efficient, or which is faster in booting and everything. And they came up with a second one, which is Slick, which is just a tiny distribution based on SUSE Linux, so it's a one CD distribution coming with one desktop.
Kind of like a lightweight distribution.
Kind of lightweight distribution, yes.
So as far as people joining the project, are there any particular needs or areas where you're looking for developers or testers to come into?
There are no special needs. We're happy about everybody coming, everybody joining, and we're open for any discussions, any suggestions, and by and large, what's needed now comes through the discussions through the day. So we are we have these ongoing discussions on mailing lists, on IRC channels, and sometimes it happens. Hey, we need in this area some help, and then people come and say, hey, I can help.
Do you have ever meetups or conferences where everybody gets together or no?
Yes, we have conferences. We have biweekly IRC meetings, where a big part of the SUSE Linux the development guys participate, and many community guys as well.
Yeah.
This is always scheduled on the OpenSUSE.org page that you can find on the front page when the next meeting is.
Is most of the development still coming from Germany?
Yes.
Yeah, Germany loves SUSE. Everybody we talked to who's German loves SUSE.
Yeah, in Germany, definitely SUSE Linux is the distro number one.
And Denmark, too.
One of the things that about SUSE that I always liked, and when I remember getting the first box set of SUSE about 6 years ago, and you open that thing up, and it has such a beautiful manual. I mean, the documentation that comes with SUSE is, I think, second to none.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really great stuff. Now, the documentation, obviously, SUSE develops that. Is there in OpenSUSE, is there that equivalent Documentation available in electronic format?
The whole documentation is available in electronic format at opensuse.org as well.
Okay. Now, is that strictly developed, that documentation developed in-house, or do you get support from the community also with developing documentation?
We're getting support from the community as well, and we are asking for support especially. So the documentation team was very happy about opensuse.org, as they now have an interface to get better feedback and get content from the community as well.
Oh, that's great. So you are looking for people to help contribute documentation.
Yes.
That's some good stuff, because I think that's lacking in a lot of Linux projects and distributions.
Yeah.
There's some really good documentation. You guys do a fantastic job with that. Fantastic. So how has the opinion of SUSE, as we just said, it's big in Germany, big in Denmark, really pretty big in Europe in general. How has Novell, that's been probably seen more as a company, in a United States company, how has that tarnished the reputation of SUSE over in Europe, or is it, you know, have they been accepting to the change?
If who should accept to the change?
I mean, over there, has the perception of SUSE changed at all in Europe since moving from being like a German company to falling under the umbrella of an American company, so to speak?
To my knowledge, I don't have any negative feedback, especially out of Europe, concerning the acquisition of Novell. As we stay with the SUSE Linux product, so we have still the box in retail. We have now with the opensuse.org project the software for free download, and going forward with the enterprise server and the enterprise desktop, and we stay still green. So by and large, most of the people appreciate it and see the advantage of being part of a large company as well. So especially for the enterprise product, we can now we can provide with Novell a proper support worldwide, which was very very challenging prior to the acquisition.
So it's a win-win situation, is what you're saying.
I would say it's a win-win situation, yeah.
Now, over in your booth, you have an iguana over there. Is it an iguana, or...?
It's at our booth. We just have the Geeko, the KDE guys.
That's
living
the KDE. That's right. I'm thinking. I'm looking at that. That's not okay. So yeah. All right. I apologize.
I have two iguanas. If you want them, we could come by and get them. My brother has two iguanas that are like enormous, and he can't get rid of them.
I think for the next show that this would be quite interesting, because it's fun having an iguana.
You have to take care of them all year.
The whole year, yeah.
Did you ever play around with an iguana?
No,
you have, right? Jimmy?
Yeah, they got big claws.
Did you ever get whipped by their tail?
Oh, yeah.
Holy mackerel,
yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah.
They'll whip you with the tail, and I've been bitten by one too. Yeah.
Oh.
Fun stuff. So now, do you live in the United States now, or you?
No, I'm living in Germany. So
okay,
SUSE Linux is still based in Nürnberg, which is in the southern part of Germany, and most of the Linux development still take place in Nürnberg.
Right. So what part of you lived in Nürnberg then?
In Nürnberg, yes.
Yeah, oh, that's Germany. Such a nice country. But so they flew you in for the Linux World Expo, huh?
Yeah.
And now, have you ever been to Boston before?
Yes. As well, now as we are with Noel, we are more often in Boston, in Provo. So, and the exchange between the different development teams becomes bigger and bigger. So the Linux development mainly still takes part in Nürnberg, but here in Boston as well, and in Provo as well.
Now, have you sat in on any of their usability studies that they've been conducting?
No.
No. So you're not involved in that type of aspect of the development of OpenSUSE?
I am not deeply involved in those usability studies.
Okay. So then, now we've determined that you like to switch between desktops, and are you a developer also?
No, I'm coming from a complete different area. I worked prior to my job at SUSE Linux in the event business.
Okay, so you manage everything. You're a coordinator.
Exactly.
So to speak.
I started at SUSE Linux at product marketing. Now I'm in product management, and I'm kind of the coordinator.
So you herd the cats is what you do. And now, that's an interesting question would be, in the corporate environment, you have people with defined roles and deadlines and they have their assignments. But on a community end, you don't necessarily have that level of structure. Is that hard to mix those two together? I mean, do you notice any problems, or has the quality of the community been, you know, on par?
The quality of the community is unbeatable. So we have made only very positive experience. So if we tell the community, for example, some content for manuals or whatever has to be ready till March 10 or so, by and large, it is ready. So we haven't had any problems with being on schedule with the community.
Oh, that's great. That is great. And it's great that you guys are doing that. Yeah. Somebody's stepping up.
I have one question. So who's going to win the World Cup?
I don't have a clue.
You don't follow football?
I'm not a soccer fan. I know there's the World Cup coming. I know that some nice teams are in, but I don't have a clue.
Oh, you don't follow it. Okay. You're getting off easy. That's okay. Michael, we want to thank you for coming. Yeah. We appreciate talking to you, about the OpenSUSE project, and we're looking forward to great things from you in the future.
You got some OpenSUSE discs over there?
We don't have discs at the booth, as we are at the moment in the beta phase of 10.1, so no discs available today. But one thing I'd like to say, at OpenSUSE.org, we will offer pretty soon a public build service, which allow the community to come with their sources to the build service, and the build service makes packages out of it. At the first step, those packages are for SUSE Linux only, but in the near future, we plan to provide this service for other Linux distributions as well. So you can build your packages for SUSE Linux, for Fedora, for Debian, and so on.
Oh, you know, I heard about that. Now, that is something where you bring the source code and you put it into, you upload it or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it'll build the package right there for you. So if I'm not a developer, if I'm just a user and I go out there and I say, wow, I like this application and I would really like to have it tried out on SUSE, but there's no package for it.
Yeah.
You take the source code and bump it up to you guys, you're going to build a package?
Exactly.
Now, will that do, like, if there's dependencies that it requires, will that also
be solved?
It'll also go out and get the dependencies, too?
Yeah.
Wow. That is great. And you're going to do that for other distributions, too?
We intend to do this for other distributions as well. And perhaps if you have time, or some other visitors of LWE, today at 7:30 p.m., Adrian giving a talk in the Birds of a Feather area in room 151B, exactly about the upcoming build service at OpenSUSE.org.
Wow. Check it out.
And I guess that solves one of the problems there, where you're saying, one of the complaints people say is, well, I go find this package that I want to use, this piece of software, but I can't install it because it's not for, it's for Red Hat, but not for SUSE.
Yeah.
It's for Debian. And this will hopefully solve a lot of those issues. Yeah. That's great. I look forward to that, and I'll see if I can hit the Birds of Feather. But I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Great talking to you, Greg. Mike.
And I bring along some T-shirts for you guys.
Awesome. Great. We appreciate it.
The second interview we have coming up is Kevin Carmody, which I have not listened to because I was in the process of finding my way to the convention center.
Dan was recovering from his night of fun and festivities
with Jeremy Garcia.
So I had to pick up the slack, and I did the interview with Kevin. And Kevin gave us a really good interview. He gave us a nice overview of what Linkspire is up to these days. He talked a little bit about the Desktop Linux Summit, which is coming up in a couple weeks in San Diego, and some of the other projects that the Linkspire people are involved with, and also what Michael Robinson is involved with mp3tunes.com and the Sideload project. So give it a listen and enjoy. Thanks.
Hi, this is Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show, and we're here with Kevin Carmody from Linkspire. Kevin, welcome to the show. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's actually great to actually meet you in person. We spoke last time. It was April of last year. This was right around the time that Linkspire 5.0 came out, and a lot of things have happened since then. You guys have made some real inroads into the box sellers preloading Linkspire.
Yep. That's what we set out to do 4.5 years ago, I guess it's been now. And you know, from day one, that was our plan. We knew that people don't buy operating systems. Very few people buy operating systems. Very few people download operating systems and burn a, you know, you say to the average person, come to our website, download an ISO, and install an operating system, and that's like, you might as well tell them to fly to the moon.
Yeah, the eyes glaze over.
The eyes glaze over. I mean, obviously, to the traditional Linux crowd, that's no big deal. That's like speaking their language. But 99% of the world, they do not have a clue what you're talking about. 95% of all Windows users get Windows by buying it pre-installed on a computer. So they've never even installed Windows before. So that's, from day one, that was our plan, to get a good operating system, work with the OEMs, get it pre-installed, and then let consumers just buy the computer, and wham, Linux is there, everything works.
A lot of people talk about the pre-installed Linux system. You guys are the ones who are actually doing it.
Yeah, and again, I think it's because we made that the goal. We knew from day one that was the strategy. Literally, we hired a guy, Larry Kettler, was one of the very first employees we ever hired, and we said, that's your goal. Create a builder's program, create an OEM program. So before we even really had an operating system, we had the beginnings of our OEM program. Today we have about, we have hundreds of OEMs in the program, but we have 350 active OEMs. You may have just heard recently Hewlett-Packard announced in South America pre-installing Linspire on a laptop, which we were very excited about. Medion in Germany, a very big tier 2 OEM throughout Europe, is now selling Linspire desktop computers throughout Europe, which we're very excited about. So we knew we had to start at the tier 3 OEMs, the little guys, white box manufacturers. They're looking for something to compete against the Dells. You know, you've got Dell that has this economies of scale, but the little guy, by replacing the Microsoft tax with Linux, can literally now compete with Dell. So the tier 3s are now putting pressure on the tier 2s. The tier 2s are now joining on, which then puts pressure on the HPs and the Dells, and eventually they have to then respond.
PCs have become throwaway items, it seems. You know, you see $200-$300 boxes that people buy, they use for a couple of years, and then they get a new one in a couple of years.
Yeah.
I think what you guys are doing taps right into that market.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, a lot of people think that Linspire is only about the really ultra affordable low box PCs. Hey, we think Linux is great on a lot of different kind of desktops and laptops, but clearly where it's going to get some early traction is when it comes to affordability and cost. That's why you walk into Fry's and there's a $200 PC running.
You can't beat that. Somebody sees a $200 machine, it's got all the software already on there, why not?
Yeah. I was very happy to see some, you know, the big magazines were actually reviewing that machine, gave it very favorable reviews. I think they expected it to be literally a throwaway machine. Turn it on, maybe swap the hard drive out or something to use it as a spare hard drive, and then throw the rest away. But they were surprised. No, this thing actually really does work. And so, I mean, 40% of the homes in America still don't have computers. 85% of the homes in Mexico do not own computers because they're just too expensive and they can't afford it. So by starting there, we're getting our foot in the door. We're you know, when you talk about a $1,500 computer, the difference between $1,600 and $1,500 with or without Windows is insignificant.
Right.
But when you talk about a $200 computer that now would be 33% more expensive to have Windows, and then if you start adding software, Office, and the rest, you're talking, you know, it starts to make a big difference. So that's where we're certainly making inroads, and we're starting, be that in emerging markets like Latin America and India, or whether it's here domestically with Fry's and Micro Center, Walmart, Sears, Target, all selling Linux computers now, which is pretty amazing.
It sounds like you're really pushing into Mexico. That seems to be a big initiative for you guys.
Yeah, Latin America, I think, is a, you know, some of these emerging markets where affordability, they're very sensitive to that. Those are good, fertile grounds for Linux in general, not just Linspire.
Now, it's been a year around when Linspire 5.0 came out. When is the next major release coming out?
We're working on, we actually are kind of quietly releasing 5.1. In fact, it may, as we speak, be in available for download right now. What we did is we basically took 5.0, added even more hardware certification, more hardware support to it, added a few additional things, and that's 5.1. And we decided not to make a big deal out of that, although it is a significantly better product. And if it's not available for Linspire users to download now, I mean, literally any day now, that's supposed to hit. I become a little desensitized to it because I've been using it for a while now. But 6.0, which will have, you know, new features and all the bells and whistles and whatnot, you'll see us make some announcements about that at DLS, but that's around the corner. We definitely, and again, I hate to tease the audience here, but at DLS, Desktop Linux Summit, which is April 24th and 25th, we will be making a very, very big announcement, something very different and new for Linspire, but clearly still in the desktop Linux space, which is pretty exciting. All I'll say is it's definitely desktop related. It's definitely Linux related. And I think it's something that's long time overdue, and we're very excited, and we'll be talking about it at
DLS. The last time we spoke, we talked about some of the apps that come with Linspire. You know, what is it? You have the photo
Elphoto,
application, the music application.
Elsong, Elsongs, and then EnView, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the web authoring
right.
tool.
Which is fantastic. I use that myself.
Yeah. So, no, and that's a big part of desktop Linux. I mean, I'm sitting here at Linux World. This show is clearly more about enterprise and servers. But when you talk about desktop, it's a different set of applications. You need audio players. You need video editing.
That's what I was going to. When we talked last time, we brought up the whole point about video editing that, you know, right now it seems the most easiest one for most people to use is Kino. And it's still not 100% easy for, you know, a novice to start using it.
Right. No, and we on our hit list, we have two apps on the hit list, which one is financial, you know, a Quicken type replacement. And you've got a few okay ones out there, but we still really don't have that one that can compete at the same level as Quicken. And then video editing, same issue there. So those are ones that, again, nothing to announce yet, but those are two very obvious holes in the desktop Linux space that Linspire would like to...
It seems for, like, desktop Linux to really take off, it just needs a little more polish and a few apps here and there for really
yes.
to be complete.
Absolutely. And, you know, and 4.5 years ago when I got involved, it was a long ways away. I mean, even web browsing didn't really work that well. You couldn't go to a lot of the popular websites 4.5 years ago and have everything kind of work. But, you know, over the last 4.5 years, all of a sudden Office Suite productivity seems to kind of gotten solved. You've got the compatibility with Excel, you know, spreadsheets and Word for Windows documents. So OpenOffice and StarOffice have gotten better and better over the last 4 years. The operating system itself. But it is a big job. I mean, you know, when we set out to do this, we were thinking, well, we'll just kind of be a clearinghouse for a lot of the applications and try to get some momentum for the desktop. But it really isn't just the OS. It's absolutely the applications. And so I think Elsongs and Elphoto and these things have gone a long ways. But there are still a few more holes. And what happens is every time you plug a hole, you expand the number of people who can use Linux today. Like for me, I run Linux full time, and I don't really, you know, because I don't do video editing.
Right.
So today, it works fine for me. Now, if I'm a video editor, however, I'm still a little bit on the outside. So as soon as that hole gets plugged, great. Then all that group of people can join the desktop Linux momentum.
One of the real big issues which Linspire has addressed is codecs, codec support and codec licensing. You guys went out and made a deal where you're able to put MP3 support right out of the box, flash support right out of the box. How difficult was it to do that?
Well, I think there's two levels. Well, actually, there's three levels of the difficultness of that. The first is a cost issue. The second is a technical issue. And the third is just a philosophical issue. You know, a lot of the open source community and a lot of the other companies, they're just philosophically opposed.
The free software people don't want to have
exactly.
licensed closed codecs.
That's right. They're like, if it's not, you know, open sourced, if it's proprietary in any way, we don't want to be involved with it. But Linspire takes a much more practical
more consumer base.
Definitely. I mean, it's unrealistic to think that the millions and millions of iPod users are going to toss their iPods in the garbage. And so, you know, you have one philosophical bent, which is, if we hold firm with OGG or whatever, eventually the world will change. And Linspire's approach is, no. You've got to welcome the world in with what you do have. Let them see how awesome Firefox is. Let them see how great KDE and GNOME can be. Let them see how great OpenOffice is. And so you bring them in, but if you say, oh, to experience Firefox and OpenOffice and Linux, you can't use your iPod. And you can't watch DVDs. And you can't do Java, Flash, QuickTime, and all the rest. They're just not going
to
do it.
They have to be there. If you're going to have a desktop Linux, you have to have everything.
Absolutely. I mean, 99% of the world does not... I hate to say it, but they don't care about open source. They're not developers.
Right.
They really don't feel the heavy hand of Microsoft bearing down on them. Inside of the industry, we understand that. We understand it kills innovation. That's why we want to change that. But 99% of the rest of the world, they're not really understanding that. So we have to welcome them in, tell them, no, this will play DVDs, this will work with your iPod, this will do everything that the Windows world is doing, and then they're going to go, wow, this is pretty great, and it's affordable, and it's more innovative, because there's a lot of innovation in things like Firefox that you don't get in Internet Explorer. So it's just a different philosophical view. So from that perspective, we've always felt that way from day one. We answer not to the religion of open source. I have no problem admitting that. We answer to the consumer. If the consumer says, I want to play MP3s, we're going to make sure they can play MP3s. As far as technically implementing this stuff, that one's not too tough at all. I mean, you know, if you get the codecs and whatnot, technically, I mean, that's what, you know, we do in this business is we solve technical problems. The third one, the cost and the licensing issues, that certainly is an issue for some.
That's where I want to go.
Yeah, I mean, Windows Media and MP3 and DVD, those things you write checks for and you have to pay for. And so you can't just throw that into a completely free distribution.
Now, that's something you have to negotiate with the holders, right?
Yeah, you have to negotiate. You have to enter into licensing agreements. You have to make payments. You have to do a prepayment, which costs a lot of money.
Right.
Obviously, Windows Media, you're dealing with Microsoft, so not necessarily the easiest company that you know to negotiate with.
Why would they want a license to you?
Yeah, well, and again, you know, we had a... I can't talk about it too much, but we had a legal issue with them that got resolved, and part of that resolution was making sure that we had access to the Windows Media.
Where do you go going forward?
I think where we go next is you've hit on a little bit, definitely more applications needed, continuation of polish and fit and finish to the existing operating system and applications. Definitely more channel education, educating the Dells and the HPs. You know, I get asked all the time, well, why doesn't Dell just start shipping a desktop Linux product? You have to understand, Dell is number one. When you're number one, there's no reason to change things. If you're on top of the pile, change is bad.
Yeah,
that can only shuffle
the deck.
They
have to have a valid reason.
They have to have a valid reason.
Make a major shift like that.
And that means demand. They got to have customers coming to them saying, I want this. So we're trying to, again, starting at the bottom, create that demand going forward. So definitely more work with the OEMs over time as that demand, because that is starting to happen now. I mean, when you've got companies like HP and Medion, which are shipping Linux computers, what's exciting for me about, like, Medion, for example, they're not just saying, oh, this is just an affordable kind of throwaway computer. They're embracing Linux. They're saying, no, Linux as a platform has a lot of advantages beyond just cost. It's more stable. It's more secure. It is open. So there are other things besides just the cost of this that makes it exciting. So Medion is embracing that in a larger way so that now it's not just about, hey, Dell, you can offer a computer for $100 less.
Mm-hmm.
No, Dell, you need to supply this because they're starting to become demand. People are saying, I want a Linux computer. I'm tired of viruses, etc.
One question I want to bring up that, I don't know, you're probably really tired of hearing it from people, is allowing people to run as root. We talked about it last time and you addressed it. Are you still going to allow people to be able to run as root?
Yeah, I mean, I think if there was an underlying theme about Linspire, we're a bunch of libertarians. We believe in freedom of choice. We believe government is bad to be telling people everything that they have to do. And I think that carries forth with software too. I mean, it just seems a little heavy-handed to say you must run your computer a certain way. Now, all that being said, I mean, that's our philosophy, is the person who buys that computer, that's his computer. He should be able to run that any way he wants. So we don't cross that heavy-handed line of, no, we're not going to let you do something you want to do with your computer. However, we do everything we can so that they don't run as root. I mean, when they log in, it's the first thing it does is it sets up an admin password, and then it says, now let's set up users. And we give them security issues and why you want to do this and why this is important and why you need to do this. We just stop short at forcing them to do that. Now, if we had a Linux that was for enterprise, if we had a Linux that was more a community-sponsored thing, we would do that.
Absolutely.
We would force that. That would be part of the process. But when you're doing a consumer Linux and you're trying to do everything you can to imply that you really need to do this for security reasons, I just think at this point now it's a little bit of a philosophy that we don't want to force people. I always hate that. I hate that when I get a computer and it starts doing the thinking for me because it says, no, I'm smarter than you. That really upsets
That's
me.
It's Apple.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Perfect example. And that works great when they kind of dummy it down to some level. But at some point, you're like, no, I want to have a little control over this.
We had this discussion last night with Jeremy from Linux Questions. It's like, if Linux is going to be mass adopted, something has to give. Do you give up the stability? Do you give up the security?
Yeah, I think you have to find the happy mix there.
Right now, you know, it's mostly the geeks, us.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what the advantages are. We know we like the choice of being able to mix and match applications and desktops. But for mass consumer adoption, does it really have to be only one desktop?
Yeah. No, I mean, this. I think an analogy would be if you walked into a car showroom and you're looking at all the traditional cars, and then off in the corner you see this really hopped-up, interesting sports car. And you say, what's that? Oh, that's the brand-new, really cool WYSIWYG sports car. It gets twice as much fuel. It goes twice as fast. Oh, by the way, it's almost free. It doesn't cost hardly anything to get. However, you need to kind of join a cult to run that car. You need to learn a whole new set of languages to run that car. You need to go through a whole new layer of security so the car's not stolen. At some point, no matter how sexy and interesting that car is, they're going to say, you know, that's not going to work for me. And so it's about finding that balance for each market. Business consumers or business users are going to be very different than consumers. And even consumers, there might be a wide range. Are you looking for a gaming PC? Are you looking for just a really basic instant messaging PC? Is this a PC for kids?
Right.
If this is a PC for kids, things like web filtering and virus and things become maybe more important. So you got to market the right product to the right market.
Now, it's probably a very good first PC for a lot of people. But it's also a very nice second PC if you have a couple of kids. You get a cheap box, have them running, and you're happy that it's Linux running underneath the hood.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I spent a lot of time explaining to people, hey, listen, this is not an all-or-nothing proposition. Particularly in businesses, it's not like you have to have every computer running the same operating system in your business. A lot of companies have Windows everywhere, but their graphics department are all running Macintosh. So I say, hey, listen, it's not that hard to let certain people in your organization run Linux if they don't need the applications or specific things for Windows. Well, the same is true in your home. Maybe your first computer is a $1,500 Dell with the multimedia WYSIWYG, everything under the sun. But if you have even two people in your family, well, you're going to get a lineup for that computer. So go run to Fry's or wherever, buy a second, third, fourth, fifth computer for home for very affordable email, web browsing, word processing, spreadsheet, all of that beautifully. In fact, I would say better than Windows does on a lot of the internet stuff, and save a ton of money. No reason to not have one computer for everybody in your home at this stage.
One of the things that jumped out about Linspire 5.0 was the fact that you had flash tutorials walking through the applications, explaining what they do, how to do it. To me, that was very good. For someone coming in who has no knowledge whatsoever, I think this is key.
Yeah, and I mean, and that shows you the extreme where we are when it comes to ease of use. I mean, the traditional Linux company, they assume you know how to burn an ISO and install and partition your hard drive. With Linspire, we don't even assume you know how to browse the internet.
All you do is turn a computer on.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy, the salesman at the store may have shown you how to do that. And then when you turn that on, it walks you through. How do I do email?
Yep.
How do I do web browsing? And again, to the Linux community, they probably think that's pretty strange. But once again, there's a lot of homes that have never even had a computer in it before.
Right.
You start getting into emerging markets like Mexico. These guys have never browsed the web. They've heard of the web, they know it exists, but they maybe never have owned a computer and done that. I don't want them calling Walmart up and saying, hey, Walmart, how do I set up my email? So we put these audio tutorials that are narrated in their own language to really walk them through it. That's the extent we're trying to take ease of use.
As far as customer support, I know when we talked to you last time, you were talking about your forums, that you had a very large base of people there going in there, and most of the issues are handled through the forums. Is that still the case?
Yeah, well, we have different levels of support. I mean, if you don't pay us any money whatsoever, we got our knowledge base, which is great. You know, pretty much every question you could imagine is probably in our knowledge base that is free for anybody to use. We have our community forums, which are fantastic. We have an awesome community. I always tell people, hey, go into our community, post a question. Usually within 30 minutes, you got a great, correct answer. However, if you are a member of the CNR service, you do have access to our paid-for programs, which would be you can email us, and then within a quick time frame, you're going to get an email back.
Or you can
phone us. Yes, we've offered that for a while now.
That seems to be the barrier that a lot of the bigger companies from doing a rollout, they don't want to have to do customer support. And they don't have the infrastructure in place to handle that.
Yeah. No, I think from day one, I mean, we've always had people answering the phones and doing support. We just kind of draw a line that you have to have at least paid us some money to get access to that level of support. So if you go to linspire.com/support, you're going to see a nice little walk you through process. It's going to say, step one, look at our knowledge base and our most frequently asked questions. If that didn't work, step two, why don't you go to the forum and see if that helps you, because there's a lot of great information there. Step three, go to the tutorials. Maybe it helps you there. Step four, send us an email. Step five, call us. Right. So we have a little pipeline that we try to go from, you know, as low touch
filter
as possible
everybody out
to get them answered without us being overwhelmed by it. But we definitely do have full-time support people answering emails and answering the phone.
One of the programs that I liked in Linspire was L Songs, and it's basically integrated with mp3tunes.com, which is a great website, great service. I bought music from there. One of the things that really popped out was recently was the sidebar. You guys were actually giving away music.
Oh, right, yeah.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Well, the Sideload.
Yeah, Sideload.
Yeah, that's Michael Robertson. That's part of the MP3 Tunes company. And that's a great site. What it does is, you know, there's a ton of free music out on the Internet that's legally available. And so what these independent artists, they'll put one or two tracks. So what Sideload does is if you're surfing anywhere out on the Internet and you see an MP3 that's available on a band site or whatever, you can, if you're running the little Sideload plugin, you can quickly add that to your MP3 Tunes locker.
Okay.
It then takes all of those links, it creates charts, and then you can go to the Sideload site and it lists thousands of these songs from all over the web. So just on one site, you can just sideload and dump all this into your locker.
Well, one of the things that really jumped out was, you know, for the longest time, MP3 Tunes was mostly small independent artists, but the songs that were offered recently were some real big name artists.
Yeah, well, the major labels, I mean, they understand that as well. They give away songs, they have free tunes that are available as well. And I'm sure some illegal stuff trickles up there, but there's a process where if anybody sees an illegal tune, they can with one click basically report it and it gets removed from the system. Because Sideload.com is definitely, or you know, the Sideload program is definitely not intended to be some kind of a Napster thing to exchange illegal music. That's not its intention at all. Its intention is there are hundreds of thousands of legal and free songs available on the net. Let's sweep them into one pile, make it one click easy to add it to your MP3 locker, which is then integrated within Linspire's L Songs.
I think it's a great idea. I used it.
Yeah. You know, Michael's doing a lot of interesting things. You know, he's got MP3 Tunes, which is back to his MP3.com roots of independent music and digital music. He has a SipPhone and Project Gizmo, which is all about VoIP. Gizmo is integrated into Linspire. He now just recently launched the whole Ajax thing. Every week he's launching a new Ajax program. In fact, video editing was what he launched, is launching this week. I shouldn't say launched because I've just seen the early Michael's Minute. Well, it's Ajax, so it's very simple, very basic, but it's pretty amazing that Ajax is doing this.
Is it something like YouTube where you upload a video file?
Yeah, you upload a video file, and then using this Ajax client, you can edit and modify that and change that around. Yeah, and so even for Linspire users, because it's Ajax, it works under Linspire.
Web-based, yeah.
Web-based.
Got to check that out.
So the first one they launched was a word processor, which was pretty amazing. Then they did a little drawing sketch program.
Right.
And then this week they're doing a video editing program. So every week, they've been working on this for a long time, so clearly they have them kind of queued
up. There was quite a buzz about the word processing program. A lot of people were talking about that.
Oh, yeah, they had like 600,000 documents were created in the first couple of days of that thing being launched. So clearly a lot of interest in Ajax. And Linspire is embracing that. That's what I love about Michael Robertson. You know, I'm the CEO of Linspire, so I eat, sleep, and drink full-time Linspire. But then in our same building, you got Michael Robertson with all these other companies doing cool things with VoIP, with Gizmo, doing cool things with MP3 Tunes, doing cool things with Ajax. And we get the benefit without me spending one dime or hiring one person. All that gets bolted into Linspire to make that a better experience.
So let me ask you, where are most of your developers from? Are they from around the world? Or?
Well, we have an office in San Diego, and we like to keep everybody there. Mm-hmm. Now, we do have some people, Everaldo, who's just, like, to me, Mr. Icon, you know, does wonderful graphics for Linux. He's out of Brazil. He works full-time for us. So we certainly do have some people that are outside of San Diego, but really we like to keep them under the roof. And if you ever come to our offices, which we welcome anybody to swing by and greet us and meet us, even the office is completely open. There are no walls. All the desks are just there together. So every employee from accounting to marketing to the engineers are all in this great big office, rubbing shoulders, sharing information. So we think there's a lot of benefit by having the group together under one roof. And then that's a little different. I mean, you look at a company like Ubuntu. I've been to Mark's offices, and, you know, they have two or three employees there, right. And then all the rest are all over
the world. Yeah.
And then that has its advantages, too. But you definitely lose a little bit of the synergy. If you come to Linspire, you sense an energy and it's a completely different vibe. So we try to, you know, we've paid to have a lot of people move to San Diego. The good thing is we're in San Diego.
You're hiring some very talented people.
Talented people, and because they're in San Diego, they love the sunshine.
Sure.
There are worse places to have to move and relocate to. It's kind of expensive there, but I love living in San Diego. So we got some really talented people.
Now, the upcoming Desktop Summit, what are some of the things you're looking to accomplish with that?
This is our fourth year. The summit has had an interesting history. I mean, the very first year we did it.
Yes, I remember that.
There was some controversy, and I always like to clear that up. Basically, what happened that first year is we reached out and hired somebody from one of the organizations to kind of help us coordinate it. And we told them, listen, this has got to be mainstream. Don't make this a developers conference. There's already plenty of those. We don't need more developers conferences. We need something that Walmart will come to.
Right.
We need something that Dell will come to. We need mainstream appeal. We want the media there understanding what desktop Linux is. And so this person went out and started getting a lot of speakers that were more the traditional. And that was fine to have some of those, but she like filled up every speaker slot. So we then said, wait a minute, we got to have some mainstream stuff in there. And then that kind of blew up and it got spun out of proportion. So then people were assuming, oh, we're trying to control them. This is the Linspire show.
People thought, you know, Novell has their own BrainShare show, mm-hmm. which is a big thing where they invite people that, you know, they're big customers.
Yep, Red Hat has their show.
Right. Everybody has their own show. I guess the impression was that you took over the show, you hijacked it.
Right. And that was never the intention. That was never the plan. If people only knew how many times I've been down on my knees begging everybody to come.
Yep.
Xandros, you need to be there. Mandriva, you need to be there. Ubuntu, you need to be there. I mean, I did a whole Linspire letter explaining this. Guys, we can't, we're Linspire. I mean, we're a tiny nothing compared to Microsoft. There's no way Linspire on its own can take on Microsoft.
Right.
We need our cousins in arms, the Novells, the Red Hats, the Ubuntus, the Mandrivas of the world, to participate in this process. And the market's plenty big enough. I mean, our niche, consumer desktop. We don't touch servers.
Right.
We don't touch enterprise. We're consumer desktop. So there's plenty of room for everybody to come to DLS and work together. And so we're thrilled this year. I mean, so over the years, little by little, more people started coming, and they saw that the show really was not the Linspire show.
Right.
This year, we've got Red Hat as a platinum sponsor. We have Novell as a platinum sponsor. We have Ubuntu as a gold sponsor. Linspire, obviously. I just talked last night with Xandros. I said, why aren't you going to be there? And they said, this is the second year you've done this show at the same time as the Toronto Linux World. You know, we always avoid Linux World, but we didn't think, wait a minute, Toronto Linux World. So they're in Canada, so clearly that's a big show for them. So so they won't be there, but that's the only reason it's a date conflict.
There.
Excuse me?
KDE.
I don't know if they have a booth or whatever.
Yeah,
but
Aaron Seigel's going to be
okay,
there.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I don't know all. Everybody. I do know this. I think we're sold out. I think all the booths are gone. We've moved the venue. The last 2 years we did it at the Del Mar County Fairgrounds, which was always an interesting place because it was like in this big kind of warehouse. The next door would be the gun show.
Right.
Now we're doing it at the Grand Hyatt, downtown San Diego.
Nice.
So you got restaurants, you got hotels.
Very beautiful downtown.
Beautiful facility. Much more conducive for having the speakers here and the exhibits there. So this show is really going to be great. I mean, last show I was pretty happy with, but the second it was over, I walked up to the people who were putting it on. I says, listen, here's everything we need to change for next year. Better venue, etc. The other thing I'm very excited about, which this will definitely be a little bit of a sneak preview for your audience here because I haven't mentioned it publicly to anybody, is because we never wanted to be in the trade show business. That's not a fun business to be in. That's a lot of work. But we want a show dedicated to the desktop. So we got the ball rolling. We've done this for 4 years now. I think people this year are going to see, wow, this is really a nice show. So what we've been doing this year is trying to get this group of people say, listen, let's turn this over to a broader group.
Okay.
Instead of Linspire heading this up, let's have a group of the Red Hats and the Novells doing this. And we've been working hard, and hopefully If it all comes together, we'll actually announce that at DLS as well, so that the fifth annual DLS will not be run by Linspire, but will be run by this whole group of Linux supporters.
It's fantastic if you get it done.
Yeah, and we want that, you know. So if it doesn't happen and we have to put on the fifth year ourselves again, hey, don't blame us for not being inclusive. If people only knew to the extent we want IBM, Intel, HP,
I've read
Dell.
Some of the articles. Are you guys really reaching out to everybody to be, you know, participate and to make it a better thing?
Yes. I mean, and this is not unlike what Michael did at MP3.com. You know, MP3.com, there were a lot of companies obviously involved in MP3. You had Real Audio and tons of people and the MP3 players. But Michael's like, there needs to be a show for this. So he created the MP3 Summit. And people at first were probably a little skeptical. Wait a minute, is this MP3.com hijacking? He's like, no, guys. Nobody else was doing it, so I'm going to do it. I'll flip the bill. I'll subsidize it. And that became a very, very good show. DLS, same thing. We subsidize that. We lose a lot of money every year when we put on DLS. And so we're filling in the gaps and subsidizing it. But at the end, it's a very good event for desktop Linux.
Kevin, I thank you for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
Great news, you know, Linspire. You know, we're really interested in what you guys are doing. Keep up the good work, and perhaps we could talk again.
Appreciate it. And likewise, you keep up the good work. Keep educating the world about Linux. Thanks.
Thanks.
The final interview we have for this episode, special episode of TLLTS, Linux World Expo Day 3, is an interview with Stephen Vaughn Nichols
from Ziff Davis and eWeek. And we covered a whole bunch of great topics. We talked about codex issues, we talked about Vista, and even SCO, you know, the whole case with SCO. So Stephen, as usual, is very got some really good points, and he's very entertaining. So give it a listen and enjoy.
Hooray.
Alrighty, this is Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show, and we're here with Stephen Vaughn Nichols from Ziff Davis.
Welcome. Howdy, guys.
It's a great pleasure to actually meet you in person.
Thank you. Pleasure to meet you, too.
We talked a while back, and you brought up some great issues. We talked about codex and a whole bunch of other issues.
Yep.
What's your impression of the whole Linux World Expo here in Boston?
Well, it's an interesting show in a couple of ways. Not interesting, though, in a way that a lot of people would like it to be. You have not seen any big 2.7 release with flashing colors and light blue lights and sirens. We can't forget the sirens. But what we have seen is there's actually been some quiet but very important news, like the fact that the KDE people and the GNOME people have finally agreed to, like, bury the hatchet.
Oh, that's big news.
Yeah, make a common API. Yeah, this is really big news.
That's going to help different application interoperability between the two environments.
Yeah, I'll make a big, giant step forward that way. If you're a developer now, you just write to that, or rather, you will be able to write to
the one API. That's it.
It should
work and look the same in both.
Exactly so. And it'll work the right way in GNOME. It'll work the right way in KDE. Life is good. That will go a big step forward to making the Linux desktop a whole lot more attractive to anyone who writes applications. And from there, we really should see. I really think this is probably, I think this is the biggest step forward for the Linux desktop has ever seen, that we finally have got the people who really make this stuff happen working together instead of cross purposes. This should be great for Linux.
It seems that these trade show, it's mostly enterprise level stuff, servers, server applications, and management software.
Yeah, a lot of software and server management. I think I've seen more serious server management programs here than I have maybe in all the other Linux worlds combined. Again, you know, if you're a Joe user, that's not very exciting. But if you look at the bigger picture, if you've got people investing a lot of money and time in this stuff, that means that businesses are investing a lot of money and time, which means Linux is going more and more mainstream, which means it's going to be a lot easier for us to get Linux and open source anywhere we want. It'll just, you know, become easier for us all to work with.
Now, one of the things that we talked about you last time was the whole issue of codex.
Right.
We talked to Miguel Diacaza and Matt Friedman from Novell.
Right.
And they've developed Banshee, which is an audio player.
Right.
That has a legal MP3 codec out of the box.
Right.
This is a big, big step.
It is.
And also Linspire, we talked to Kevin Carmody.
Yep.
They have licensed codecs as well.
Right.
Is this trend going to continue? Do you think it's a snowball effect or no?
I think it is. Excuse me. It is a snowball effect, and we're going to see more of that. Actually, I was just talking to Kevin yesterday, and they're very, and over at Linspire, they're very impressed with Banshee. And what they would like to do, Nate, if you're listening, is to get together with you all and bring on some of the goodness they've already got in L Audio and bring it over to Banshee and maybe,
L-Songs.
You know, Yeah, and just take LSongs and sort of just fold it down and put all of its goodness into Banshee, because they're big believers also, and, you know, they don't want to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly, if you don't have
to. They, you know, they've got some stuff there that they don't think Banshee has, but overall they're very impressed with Banshee, and they think that maybe that will become, like, the audio player for the Linux environment, and better still, it'll make it legal to run a lot of stuff on the Linux environment.
It seems the desktop push, there's a few applications here and there
right.
that we need.
Yep.
Very few and far between. It's getting smaller and smaller every year.
Yep.
What do you think are the last final pieces that we need besides the codecs?
Final pieces. You know, we're just getting a lot closer there. You know, as I recently said in an article, you know, Velvet's doing this survey. You can go to their site and fill it out. You know, what Windows app do you want to see on Linux? And the one that was number one with a bullet was Photoshop.
Yes.
You know? And the problem, you know, I explained that. It's not that you can't do most of what you can do with Photoshop with GIMP. You can, but there's like this whole ecosystem of Photoshop add-ons, people who are set up to work with Photoshop in the next part of their, like if they're going to print out a color newspaper, they're set up to deal with Photoshop files coming in.
It seems that it's graphic artists who have worked with Photoshop over the years.
Right.
That's what they're used to. That's what they want.
Right.
They're the ones that, you know, this is what they want. You know, me or you, you know, we really don't have, like, you know, graphic background.
Right.
We could learn to GIMP and probably be happy with it. It seems that it's the people who are used to using the tools that they use.
Yeah, that's certainly part of the problem. But, you know, it's also, like I said, there's also just, besides just knowing how to use Photoshop, you've also got literally dozens of companies that have add-ons for Photoshop.
It's like a whole third-party industry.
Yeah, it's this whole universe out there. So it's not just Photoshop. It's all these add-ons that they need and they want. And also, GIMP and the, you know, like if you already know Microsoft Office, you can switch over
pretty
to OpenOffice. Yeah,
pretty
no
seamless.
Sweat, no problem.
Right.
Going from Photoshop to GIMP, though, you
different.
Know, forget, I mean, you're just learning everything over again. You're crawling. You're not walking. Or forget about running. You're crawling.
It seems lately everyone's just ragging on the GIMP. It seems they're, like, being beaten up lately by everybody.
They are, and, you know, that's not really fair. They did it their way. It's just that the market out there is just so tied into Photoshop, it's really hard for GIMP to get really into that marketplace to make a dent. You know, it's possible there's at least one open source effort out there, very small one, to make GIMP essentially have the basic interface be like Photoshop.
Right, so GIMP Shop.
Exactly. Hack. And it's not bad. It's not great, but it's not bad. It'll let you do your basic stuff if you already know Adobe, so you can get productive on the GIMP in a hurry. You can't do terribly sophisticated stuff still until you actually learn GIMP. But it's coming along there.
It sounds like the GIMP developers don't really want to have any part of that, it seems like.
You know, I don't follow GIMP that closely.
I haven't
but
talked
I do,
to them personally.
You know, I do know that there's a lot of, we've done it the right way here, and if you don't get it, if you don't buy into that, well, we're not that crazy about it. And that's, I mean, that's sort of the mistake that the KDE and GNOME people have gotten away from. They both have their idea of what the best way is to do it, but they recognize that, you know, working against each other isn't going to help anybody. They have to work together. I think maybe, you know, again, I don't know them that well, but if I'm correct and that's how the GIMP attitude is, it's we've done it right, everybody should do it our way. I think they should really think that about a little bit closer and maybe start talking about it to Adobe about, you know, maybe we could, like, do something here. And that would probably,
open
in the long run, help them a lot.
Yeah. Now, one of the articles that recently they wrote, we were talking about Vista.
Right.
You wrote Why Vista Will Suck.
Yep.
I thought it was an absolutely brilliant article.
Thank you.
I mean, for those who haven't read it, what do you think about all this?
Vista sucks. It's
you've been running the betas, right?
Yeah, I've been running the beta. I've just installed the latest. They don't call them beta anymore. Now they're technology previews. They're betas. Okay, give it up, Microsoft. We know it. They're betas. It's just a giant piece of klutzy code that requires enormous system resources to run. Now, after I did that article, I had all these Microsoft people who swore up and down.
It jumped down your throat or no?
Oh, yeah. I got, you know, people talk about how you touch a Mac person, they go, "Arr, Mac is wonderful. How dare you talk about it?" Or Linux people. Let me tell you.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. Let me tell you. They got nothing. nothing, I tell you, compared to an upset, irritated Windows person. And
it seems like they're imploding from within. You hear a lot of griping from within.
Yeah, that really surprised me. But when it came out that Vista was going to be delayed again until January, there was a lot of screaming inside of Microsoft about this, not from the managers, but from the actual guys who write this code. And they're pretty darn disgusted with how it's been going. And it's just, I mean, even from the guys inside Microsoft, they know that a lot of the goodness that was supposed to originally be in Vista, like the new object file system, which has only been talked about since 1992 when it was called Cairo, if you anybody out there remembers that far back, that's really what WinSF is, guys. It's the same project, it just has never made it. So they've had to take out a lot of the, quote, goodness, and they're left with this stuff, which is, you know, don't believe me about what's wrong with Vista. Read what the programmers themselves in the Windows Insider blogs are talking about, and they'll tell you that we've got serious problems
here. It sounds like they had really big ambitions. Mm-hmm. They tried to go for it, and along the way, they lost a little focus, and they started taking on features more and more as they went along. And it sounds like it's become more... It almost sounds like it's almost like a just, you know, XP Service Pack 3 or whatever.
You know, that's actually not too far off. I mean, they'll kick and scream when they hear that said. But, you know, it really is more... There's not really a whole lot more goodness in there than you would expect from a service pack. The only thing that's really going to be new that people will see that's quite different is going to be Aeroglass, the new interface, 3D and all that jazz.
But the whole thing with that is the hardware requirements are pretty heavy, aren't they?
Yeah, the hardware requirements are very heavy. The absolute minimum to successfully run it, and if you look at Intel's site and a couple of other sites, you'll find where they're already beginning to say, this is what the minimum really is going to be. They're going to tell you the minimum is a gigabyte of RAM, period. I mean, that's just a get it up and going. And you're going to need about a 128, seriously, though, they say 256, but they think maybe it could go up 128, depending on how much better they do at cleaning up the code between now and January. Graphics card, high-end processor. Now, okay,
what
if you're...
What about the CPU?
CPU, free gigahertz. You know, if you're not running 3 gigahertz or better, you shouldn't do it. I'm currently running it on the system that Intel describes as a minimum system. It's a... The first run of the Pentium dual chip, dual core CPUs running at 3.2 gigahertz. I got a gig of RAM. I have the bare minimum graphics. It's doggish, let me tell you. And that's a pretty high end machine that ran.
Sounds like a nice machine you got.
Yeah, it's a nice machine, but it's sort of it's the bare minimums to do it. And I, you know, that's one of the reasons why this sucks. I mean, yeah, hardware is getting cheaper all the time.
Mac OS 10, right?
Yeah, only worse. Seriously, actually, only worse. The jump from Mac 9 to Mac OS 10, as painful as that was, for Windows users, this will be even more painful. If you're thinking about upgrading your system to run Vista, forget about it. Yeah. Unless you already have a high-end gaming machine.
It's not going to cut it.
Yeah, it's not going to cut it. And for that matter, if you've got a high-end gaming machine, what do you want to put this dog on it for?
Bottom line is... It'll ship on new PCs. People will buy new PCs.
Right.
And from that standpoint, it'll be an instant success. Where it really has a really high probability of failure is on the business desktop.
Right.
Machines 1 year old, 1 to 3 to 4 years old, where they want something better than they currently have, XP or older.
Right.
And they want to go forward to a new operating system that has more features, more secure. It's not really an option. And that's where they might fail, really.
Yeah, and actually, you know, one of the things they've admitted, one of the reasons why they're delaying Vista again is, you know, I've been saying all along, they keep saying the security is better, and I keep saying, you know, when you started out with a fundamental design flaw, this was built as a single-user PC in a universe that's now everyone in the world is connected to you, but you're still built on that fundamentally broken foundation. It doesn't matter. You're always going to be fundamentally broken, and that's the same with Vista today. And businesses are looking at this, and they're not too happy about it, because even, you know, as the prices go down, you've got It's just an expensive proposition, and you really have to ask yourself, what am I really getting here?
Exactly. What are you getting?
You know, a 3D interface. Isn't that nice? You know, yeah. Again, that's more of a... Gamers might be excited about what could be done with that thing in a year or two, but yeah. if your people are just browsing the web, doing an accounting program, doing a customer relationship management, who cares? Who wants to pay extra money for a feature that you will never use?
Now, features, we could talk about features. We could talk about Office.
Right.
I mean, one version to the next.
Right.
What the hell are you getting for that $300?
There are a lot of people out there to this day using Office 97.
Because it still works.
Yeah, it still works. It still does what they want. I think Microsoft is going to have real problems with Office 2007. Not just because they're going to be fighting against their installed base, and honestly, I've asked this question to the public. No one has yet given me an answer. Tell me exactly what new feature between Office 97 and today is really important to you. Okay, just tell me what it is. You know, there's nothing. There really isn't. Nope. And this is, you know, and the winning point for Linux in this is, you know, desktop Linux, the operating system does give you more security. It doesn't require all this hardware.
It's more stable.
It's just an easier upgrade, more robust, and you get it.
Customizations
right,
easier.
And it just works, and it's cheaper, and it does give you a measurable business advantage. Now, going to Office...
And you're not tied to one vendor.
Yeah, and you're not tied to one vendor. Big deal that. I mean, Microsoft can and will charge you the world for this stuff, because if you buy into the Microsoft... If you drink the Microsoft Kool-Aid... Then you're kind of addicted to it. You're stuck. Whereas with Linux, if you really don't like what Red Hat gives you,
switch.
Yeah, Novell is right there. Ubuntu is heading towards the business market as fast as their feet can carry them. You saw more of that happening at this show, and a lot of other smaller guys. Zandros is out there. They've got to find a business desktop these days. Lots of choices here. Yep. And when you look at the Office suites, if I'm someone and I'm thinking, I want to move to a new Office suite, okay, for whatever reason, I finally lost my Office 97's floppies, or I no longer have a floppy drive to install it with, and for some reason that's the only way I got it instead of on a CD, fool that I was. Which one would you rather go to? Would you rather go to an Office 2, which does, except for accountants... does pretty much everything you would ever want to do with an Office suite and cost you, nothing. Yeah, that's right, nothing. Or you could move to this new Office, which will cost you a lot of money, doesn't really give you much, and it has an interface that is nothing at all like the classic Office interface. I can walk over, I can take any Word Excel user and sit them down in front of Office Writer or Office Calc. They're going to be able to use it. You know, some things won't be quite where they are.
But it's familiar and they can figure it out.
It's familiar. They can use it. Yep. You know, Alt-SF, sure enough, it saved it. Doesn't work that way, though, in Office 2007. You've got to learn a whole new interface. Now, I came out of the business world, and I know for a fact these people don't want to learn anything.
Nope.
But you can't really blame them. Their job is to get their job done. It's not to learn a new program. And when you're asking them to learn a new program without any real advantage to it,
why switch?
Yeah. You know, or if you are going to switch, why not go for Open Office, which will cost you basically nothing.
And it's more familiar.
There you go.
Let me ask you something.
Sure.
If things don't work out in the next couple of years for Microsoft,
right?
Some people have alluded that they're going to start bringing out the old patents and start going after people. Do you actually think that's going to happen?
I don't think it's going to happen. And believe it or not, I was talking to Daryl McBride, the CEO of SCO. Yes, Daryl and I actually do talk to each other and not just scream. And he brought up the full point. And remember, this is the guy, I mean, when it comes to suing people, McBride knows lawsuit, okay? And he doesn't think Microsoft will do it. And he made a good argument. And his argument was that it would be like mutually assured destruction, that old idea back when the U.S.
patent warfare.
Yeah. If Microsoft does this, then IBM, HP, probably even Sun, who still has no great Novell. Love for Microsoft, Novell, everybody in the world counterattacks, and everybody loses. And they think that's why Microsoft won't try to pull that card, because...
And the PR is not good.
Yeah, the PR would be awful, but even more so than the PR, even more so than having to pay, you know, big fines to somebody, it's the idea that everybody would then go to war with their patents. And it doesn't actually matter then who wins or loses. That just absolutely freezes everybody's development. Nobody except the lawyers win. And I think, you know, Microsoft's been on the losing side, actually, with a lot of litigation lately. Aeolus is grateful to the tune of about $500 million or so now. And I don't, you know, I don't think that's a road they want to go down. I think that if it really gets to the point where Microsoft is just getting beat up in the marketplace, they are going to hate it. Bill Gates will retire. Steve Ballmer will...
His head will explode.
Yeah, will explode. And they will finally start to embrace open source. They will kick. They will scream. It may take 10 or 20 years.
What do you think they
would
do? Would they port applications over to Linux?
They will start porting. There's always rumors of MS Linux, Microsoft Linux.
Yeah, it's a joke. Every April Fools, you'll see a story.
Yeah, exactly. Every April Fools. Sooner or later, they may have to come around to that. It is somewhere they do not want to go, because what they've been doing for 30 years has worked extremely well for them. What they don't get, though, is it's the way, people say that, how could that happen to Microsoft? I say it the same way it happened to the American car makers.
Absolutely.
You know?
You gotta evolve in this time. You
got to evolve. Things change. And things change faster in this IT business than they do anywhere else.
It's accelerated.
Exactly so. And they won't want to, and they'll fight it to the bitter end, just like the American car makers did. But change does happen. And I think it's becoming, looking around Linux world here, one of the things that I notice is that instead of people... I've been going ever since number one. Number one, we had maybe three-quarters young programmer-developer types, about 80%. I'd say this crowd is more like 70% middle-aged business guys. You got CIOs, CTOs.
These are the people who are going to spend money in the business.
Yeah, these guys are spending serious money for something that will do the job to get their work done. They don't really care anymore about file systems. They just care about
getting the job done the best, cheapest, quickest way.
Exactly so. And they're now looking at Linux and Apache and OpenOffice and all the rest and saying, you know what?
Can do
this
it.
Is it.
Yep.
This really does work. This isn't a matter of religious fervor.
No, not at
or,
all.
Or, oh, it's so cool. This just,
it
just
works.
Freaking works.
It works. Yep. It's a solid foundation to build upon.
Yep.
One last question before you go, Stephen, is just do me a favor. The next time you see Darryl again, is hit him upside the head with a clothes stick for me.
Well, we've had interesting conversations like that, but you know.
That's a whole other topic for another day.
Yeah, yeah. I will say one thing, though, about McBride that I think a lot of people don't get. And that is that, well, two things, actually. One, he sincerely believes he is in the right. You know, I mean, everyone else may think that he's in the wrong, but, you know, this isn't just a position. He really does believe it. And two, he is tenacious. He is a bulldog. If I were going to have to hit a beach somewhere and, you know, fight my way up it, I would not mind having Darryl McBride at my side, because, by gosh, he's going to be there and fighting all the way to the end. Now, if you're on the Linux side of the fence, this is not a good thing, but I think, you know, anyone who thinks that this is, we're still nowhere close to ending this quickly, they are not going to go away,
his company has released a version of Linux that's GPL'd?
Why, yes. We've chatted about
that's
that.
That's like the most obvious point, you know?
We've chatted about that in detail, but that's a story for another
yeah,
day.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here.
I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a pleasure to meet you in person.
Thank you.
You.